when you look at the Coast Guard and you look at our relationship with the state of Alaska and with the nation, it's unlike anybody else's. Between our authorities that we have, our ubiquitous presence around the country, our portion of us being in military service or us being military officers at all times, and then at the same time being a federal law enforcement agency and a regulatory agency is really unique and provides the Coast Guard with a unique set of responsibilities, actually 11 statutory missions. If you've had the opportunity on Wednesday nights to watch any of the Coast Guard show on TV, you'll see the missions that that we continue to go out on. Besides search and rescue and law enforcement, we have aids to navigation and other missions that really apply to the people of Alaska and help promote the people of Alaska more so in a lot of ways than almost any other location in the nation. My responsibilities go from the early side of prevention and awareness, where we work primarily in the areas of environmental protection. We're heavily responsible for regulation on that side, all the way to a response profile where incidents happened and we respond afterwards, mostly in law enforcement, search and rescue, and in some cases, as you saw with Deepwater Horizon, after a major calamity such as an oil pollution event. The Coast Guard is a military service. You all know that. We serve with the Navy in time of war. We have Coast Guard folks today around the world in the Northern Arabian Gulf protecting the oil platforms in Iraq. We've been there since the very beginning. We have folks in Afghanistan doing work there as well. So when you think about your Coast Guard and you look at how we deploy and where we've been, we're all over the world. We have a primary focus here in the U.S., but we do deploy with the other military services. And as of today, we actually have thousands of Coasties that have served in enduring freedom and Iraqi freedom and around the world doing those more higher-end DOD missions. And it's been that way since 9/11. So a lot of folks still think of the Coast Guard as a search and rescue organization or a hometown organization. We are, but we also have a broader set of responsibilities that put us around the world. The 17th District is huge. Alaska's huge. And when you look at the way our district is set up and you look at our area of responsibility, the yellow on this chart shows what I'm responsible for, which is essentially the Arctic, the Northern Pacific, all the way down to Kamchatka and Korea on the international side, all the way down to the Straits of Juan de Fuca on the U.S. side, the Bering. We have more coastline that we're responsible for in this district than the rest of the United States put together. So Alaska is a unique opportunity, and I am an Alaskan. I've been up here for many years. My kids and family are all from here. So it's a place that we come back to. I wanted to come back here, and I wanted to come back here for the challenge that the state of Alaska offers me as a Coast Guard officer and the opportunity to serve the nation in a really cool way, and in a way, quite frankly, that's it's a growth opportunity for the nation with the opening up of the Arctic, and I have a lot of comments on that later on. I look at, when I get up in the morning, I look at the things that start bothering me, and I've got a whole bunch of natural disasters that I'm always worried about, everything from earthquakes, and I'll show some stuff on that later on, which is actually the number one calamity on my list of calamities that I stay awake at night thinking about. And then there's the homemade or man-made events that occupy a lot of my time. Everything you see on this this enumerated list of things here happens in Alaska. All of the things that you see on here are issues that we worry about in our service to the state of Alaska and in our protection for the nation from here. Weapons of mass destruction, piracy, illegal migration, drug trafficking, all of those are issues that Alaska faces. If you look at vehicles of conveyance for a lot of bad things that can come into Alaska, do come into Alaska, or could threaten Alaska, the maritime environment is the primary one, whether that's commercial fishing boats, illegal fishing, or illegal transportation modes, the ferry system. A lot of that is Alaska's dependent on, and it puts it right in the Coast Guard crosshairs, more so than almost anywhere else in the nation. Talked about earthquakes a little bit. If you look back at the 64 quake and you look at the history of earthquakes and tectonic activity throughout the region. This is Alaska's like ground zero for that for the United States. The largest earthquake we ever had, obviously, was 1964. If you look at what happened in Japan, it's all part of the same earthquake system. It's something that that happens periodically about every 50 years. Here in Alaska, where we end up with a major quake, it's one of those events that is, you know, day to day a low probability of event, but a high consequence event. And when I talk to my boss and he asked me about the things that bother me, this is one of the ones that's not on a whole lot of people's radar scopes, but I am certainly worried about it. If you look at the results of the 64 quake, and then you look at Anchorage today, you look at Kodiak today, you look at the way the population of Alaska, how it's grown and how we've migrated more and more to a maritime culture and a maritime community, it's a big deal for me. It's one of those things that I look at as the Katrina type event that could happen up here in Alaska, and keeps me worried. In addition to that, Southeast Alaska with tsunami activity, I think what we saw take place in Japan is something that we ought to take a hard look at. How would we deal with that? How would the isolated communities of Alaska deal with it today, where we don't have a whole lot of infrastructure, and in some cases we even have less robust infrastructure than we had in 64. What I mean by that is, if you look, everybody's dependent on your cell phone. Well, if we have no cell phones, there's an issue. Loran stations no longer exist here. If you lose GPS, there's other problems. Ham radios and things like that that were very critical in 64, people don't even know how to spell ham radio anymore. And so those kinds of things, and those infrastructure, that kind of the old school, old technology that we had, it no longer exists, and is a point of worry for me. Talked about that. Crime. There's a lot of concern in this area for me in the state. I've been working with my state partners and my federal partners here to try to really understand what are the things that threaten the state of Alaska by way of crime. What are the conveyances for things like drugs coming into the state, and what can we do about it? Do we fully understand it? Most people in Alaska don't think of that as something to worry about. It is something that I'm looking at, and the more I look at it, the more I think we ought to worry about it. Especially when I look at homegrown narcotics traffic like crystal meth and some of the other things that are starting to take on in rural communities, not only in Alaska but around the country. It's a big deal for me as a parent, as a business person. That should be something that we all think about how we can start to address. And it's one of the places that I'm starting to partner more and more with the state and federal activities. Fishing. Alaska has the only, as of today, sustainable fisheries on the planet. And if you take a look at the Bering Sea fishery, if you take a look at the Northern Pacific pelagic fisheries around here, the state of Alaska, working with the federal government, has done an extremely good job of preserving that fisheries. We have up and down cycles on stuff, but in general, you will find that the scientific data is there that we've got about the right sweet spot on that for keeping it as a sustainable fishery. That is a huge deal. Not only is it a huge multi-billion-dollar industry that feeds directly into the state of Alaska, but it's a precious industry that the rest of the world likes to covet, look at, quite frankly, steal if they can. And if you're familiar with Bagan Picasa, which was a fishing ship, really a international criminal activity piracy ship that was the Coast Guard took down earlier this year, and I have a couple slides on it. You talk about a ship with 9 miles of net on board, sucking in everything from sharks to dolphins, and when you have 3,000 or 4,000 pounds of shark fins on board, how many sharks does it take to make that? How many are you throwing over the side so you can have some shark fins? And you look at the amount of danger that poses to our sustainable fisheries. It's an area that is of growing interest, not only to me and to the Coast Guard, but to my overseers in Washington, as we look at the returning fight for fish around the world. And really, ground zero for that for the U.S. is up here in Alaska, and I could talk forever on fish issues. Great Circle Route. It's one of those things that most people probably don't think about, but Alaska is in a very unique position for international globalized trade. If you look at the way ships travel around the world, they try to go from the shortest distance from point A to point B. Because we're a globe, it turns out that most of the stuff coming from Korea, northern Japan, and even in some cases China, the quickest way to North America is to come up through Alaskan waters, in particular to go through the Aleutian chain into the Bering and then come out around Dutch Harbor and then re-enter into the U.S. or Canada. A couple of things are taking place that are going to fundamentally change this dynamic. One is Prince Rupert, is the port of Prince Rupert in Canada, will soon be the fourth largest port on the west coast of North America. It's also looking to be, and may have the potential of being one of the largest, if not the largest, oil exporting ports on the west coast of America. All of that trade will go through the Dixon entrance. All that trade will go through the Aleutian chain twice, once at Dutch Harbor and then again on the further west, as that ship traffic looks for the shortest distance between market and source of production. That is a huge risk to the state of Alaska. As if you look at things like Solandang IU, if you look at some of the major ship tragedies that we've had in the state, they're out there in the Aleutian chain. They're a long way from any response capability. They're a long way from any cleanup capability. And they're all of the Aleutian chain is a very sensitive environmental habitat. As that commercial traffic goes through there, under international law, it's allowed to do that. There's nothing the U.S. can really do to prevent traffic due to freedom of the seas and freedom of navigation for keeping that traffic going through there. It's only going to increase. It's going to increase on our watch. It's going to increase on my watch in my short, hopefully, three-year tenure up here. And it's something that we continue to worry about. The Coast Guard is spending a lot of money to look at Aleutian traffic studies. But you put that in Dixon Entrance, for example, with now large amounts of east-west traffic, with large amounts of north-south traffic with our ferry system, in a place that has no vessel traffic separation scheme, in a place that has very limited response. It's not too long before you have a major intersection with a major problem going on. And we've actually spent a lot of time, particularly this year, training with the Canadians and doing a bunch of exercises on how we would manage an event like that. Sri Lankan migrants, you guys, we got lots of them coming over. We've got drug problems like everywhere else. If you look at the drug trafficking routes for Alaska, it's kind of sad in a lot of ways on our drug situation, because most of it comes from Canada, the U.S. So the drugs move into the lower 48, and then they come up to Alaska through primarily maritime conveyances, which is right square in the middle of my responsibility, and I need to start doing stuff about that. Piracy, we don't need to go into that too much. So D-17, that's kind of like the broad picture of stuff that's going on up here. District 17, talk a little bit about the things that are really, really tight on my watch and what I'm keeping a track of. This is our force laydown for Alaska. Not a whole lot. Like I said before, we have the largest amount of coastline in the U.S., more than the lower 48. If you look at the way the lower 48 is provisioned in Coast Guard resources, and then you look at Alaska, there's a huge difference. There's a huge difference. Just take a place like Florida or a place like New England and look at the amount of Coast Guard assets per mile, per person. And we use any denominator you want in assessing how much infrastructure and how much investment has been made. Alaska's pretty sparse. Almost all of our assets are in the lower regions of the state. Meanwhile, we have a whole new ocean and a whole new set of industries opening up in the Arctic. We need to start looking at ourselves moving further north. You know, it was 1913, we had a Coast Guard station in Nome. Today, we don't have one. Our furthest north really is Kodiak. Furthest west and north is primarily Kodiak for capabilities. Just 2 years ago, we had about 400 or 500 more coasties in the state than we do today, because we've closed down the Lowrand stations, and we've lost some of the capability and the ancillary benefits that we got from them. We've lost our maritime safety and security team in Anchorage. You all have probably seen that, which was about a 100-man force there, 100-person force there that provided maritime security options and provided us with the ability to project Coast Guard forces around the state. And we lost a Acushnet last year as well, with the decommissioning of her, our oldest cutter in the fleet. We're hoping to look to replace some of that with some of our newer assets. But as of today, we find the Coast Guard with a little bit less robust capability in the state. At the same time, we see a lot of growth taking place in the northern regions and out to the west with that increase in fishing. The Arctic. Everybody wants to talk about the Arctic. Every week I do a briefing with somebody in Washington, D.C. who has discovered the Arctic and wants to know more about it. Just this morning, I spent about an hour on a VTC with folks from around the nation talking on Arctic issues. And, everybody's like, they've discovered it. They know it's a problem. They know it's an opportunity. They know it's a great concern, but it's still a long way from anybody in Washington, D.C. to the Arctic up here. It is a real issue for the people of Alaska. It is a very real issue for District 17 from all Coast Guard, all hazards, all threats, and all Coast Guard missions. So when people talk to me about the Arctic, and they, everybody wants to go, well, geez, what happens if we have an oil spill in the Arctic? I'm worried about a whole lot of other stuff first. Normal, everyday Coast Guard missions, elisions, collisions, grounding, search and rescue. The things that we tend to do every single day in the Coast Guard whenever there's maritime activity, those are the things that I'm worried about primarily at the front of my plate when I look at the Arctic or even into the Bering and the movement of maritime activities north in the Bering. Whenever you have a lot of ships, when you have a lot of people, whenever you have folks going out doing everything from subsistence hunting to commercial fisheries to ocean transit traffic, you have an opportunity for a problem. And what I have had just in the brief 6 months that I've been here is a dozen, barge breaks loose, gonna wash up on the beach. What are you doing about it? Somebody else is a big, long search and rescue case a long way from nowhere. Kite surfers showing up on Little Diomede Island that speak Russian. What are we going to do about them? Other folks that want to drive four-wheel drive trucks across the ice from across the Bering. I mean, ridiculous amount of stuff, but it's normal activity that goes on whenever you have a lot of maritime traffic and a lot of maritime interest in an area. All of that is opening up with the Arctic. Everything from adventure tourism to regular tourist and commercial liner traffic that we see. We've had people, I got a call from Barrow where, hey, there's a whole bunch of, German-speaking people walking around town that just showed up on a boat. Where'd they come from? Who are they? Did Customs and Border Patrol vet these people? All these other questions I'm asked, and I'm like, I don't know. And, we have those events taking place. And we do have, falling in the paper, a big opportunity next summer for even more activity up there as we look to some of the industry's interest in exploration for oil next summer. And then follow on industry activity that would come behind that. I think all of it provides the state of Alaska and the United States with a great opportunity to move into a region where the rest of the planet is moving into. If you take a look at the Arctic nations, if you take a look at the statements that the Canadians have made about the strategic importance to them of the Arctic, the Russians in their relationship to the Arctic, they all consider the Arctic a key element of their national sovereignty and of their national being. The Norwegians, they're already up in the Arctic doing all kinds of work, whether it's oil exploration or fisheries and everything else. So one of the things I always tell people when I talk to them is, the U.S. doesn't own the Arctic. Stuff is going on in the Arctic, and people are moving through the Bering Strait as an international strait, whether we like it or not. So it cannot be ignored. It needs to be managed. We need to have a thoughtful plan around how we're going to develop it or not. We need to have a thoughtful plan around if we don't do something and somebody else has a problem, how would we react to that? What are our international agreements? What are our capabilities that we could put up there? So it's one of those situations where, as Americans, we tend to like to think we got this under control. It's one of those situations that's developing and moving forward, whether we like it or not, and we have to engage in it. I am glad to see that a lot of people back in the East Coast and in Washington now have discovered the Arctic and are now interested in the Arctic. I hope they listen carefully to the people of Alaska and the people that actually live up there as we go forward. There's a lot we can learn from the history that Alaskans have had in that organization, in that region, and there's a lot we can learn from Alaskan Indigenous folks who have traditional history and knowledge there that I'm continuing to promote. Yeah, oil. Everybody's talking about oil in Alaska, and everybody asks me that on a daily basis. What are you guys doing about oil? What are you doing about the riches that are up there? There's a lot of oil in the Arctic, not just in the U.S. side, but also in the Russians, the Canadians, and obviously the Norwegians who've been up there for many years. That's of interest. So, you know, that is of interest whether we want to drill, not drill. If we do drill, how do we do it safely? What are the impacts of drilling on the U.S. economy? What are the impacts of not drilling on the U.S. economy? What are those impacts on the state of Alaska? What are those impacts not only on the economics for the state of Alaska, but on the indigenous people of Alaska, on the well-being of the state of Alaska? Again, my job is not to opine on which way we should go, but my job is to inform the folks that I have to work for and people I talk to on what are the consequences of whatever avenue is decided to be taken. And one of the avenues that cannot be taken, in my opinion, is ignoring the Arctic. So we have to engage on it, we have to manage it, and we have to move forward in a thoughtful way. And I think we're doing that. I think there's been a lot of good and passionate debate on all sides of that, but I think we're moving forward in a way that's going to be provide the best, thoughtful, and safest way to develop that or not. The Bering Strait, this slide here demonstrates the two major international trade route opportunities that we have in the Arctic. One is the Northwest Passage, which is this lower green line. It's a pretty serpentine route. It's a pretty complicated route. It's one that most folks, most experts don't see fully opening up or developing for a long time, mostly because it's a very complicated route. It's got charting issues. It's got some narrow passages. It tends to ice up early and tends to never really get ice free currently from an iceberg or ice pancake ice problem throughout the summer. It is an interesting place for some adventure cruisers to go through. It is an interesting place for civilians and for private persons to go enjoy the Arctic. So that's something we're watching pretty careful. The one that I think is the route of primary interest to me is the Northern Sea Route. That's that yellow line there. This year, a member of my staff had the opportunity to go out on the Russian icebreaker Yamal and sail about half of the Northern Sea Route. What was interesting on that passage was they couldn't find any ice. So they drove around for almost 2 weeks in a nuclear icebreaker, huge nuclear icebreaker, and pretty much didn't find any ice, drove through there, saw a lot of other shipping traffic, saw a lot of other destination traffic from some of the mines that the Russians have up there. Very busy area, very little ice. If you look at it opened up about a week earlier this year and closed about 2 weeks later than it did at any previous time. We had some of the largest ore carriers, some of the largest chemical carriers that we've ever seen come through through the Northern Sea Route and right into the Bering Strait. Some of those that ship traffic I didn't know about until it was already south of the Bering Strait. So that concerns me. We're talking large non-tank vessels, single-hull vessels, carrying well over 1 million gallons worth of fuel on board. So although they're not a tanker, they do carry a lot of fuel. They do pose a huge problem if they have a grounding or an elision or collision or something like that up there in the Bering Strait. And all this has taken place in a relatively poorly charted or sparsely charted set of waters. All of this has taken place without any formal vessel traffic separation schemes that manage things like who's going north in the Bering Strait, who's going south, what side of the channel you're going to be on. All of this has taken place in a place that has extremely vexing conditions in weather and currents and some of that other stuff. the large ore carrier that came by at the end of the year with over 1 million gallons of fuel on board, single screw. So single motor, huge ship, coming from a Russian mining facility, heading south. And they told me about it after it got through there. That's why I say we cannot ignore what's going on in the Arctic, and those are the reasons why I think as a nation and as Alaskans, we have to really get our arms around this and figure out a way to proactively manage it. Good news is we're doing a lot of work with the Russians to enter into cooperative agreements on whether it's search and rescue or oil pollution response. We've got a long history of doing that with the Canadians as well. You may recall that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton earlier this year signed the SAR agreement for the Arctic International Treaty on that. Very good work there. So there's a lot of governance and structures being put in place to help develop a lot of this. But when you look at this Northern Sea Route over here, that's one of the places that I think is going to quickly grow, perhaps out of our U.S. control very fast. Talk about that. The Bering Strait, one of my predecessors called it the Bering Gate. Everything that goes in the Arctic goes through there. Because regardless of which route you take, you're going to go through the Bering Strait. And when you look at the key oil development opportunities for Canada and Russia, when you look at the key mining opportunities for Canada, Russia, and the U.S., all of that traffic would go through the Bering Strait as well. So I spent a lot of time educating our senior leaders on what that means, what capabilities we need to have, what are the requirements for the United States, how are we currently prepared, and could we best be more prepared in the future for that increased traffic. That's a real quick overview of D-17, a number of Coast Guard missions. If you take away anything from this, I think you ought to take away that Coast Guard's here, we're engaged, we're a key partner with the state and locals in a lot of locations for doing all the things that the Coast Guard's responsible for. And we tend to jump on whatever the last big exciting issue was, but again, where I sit, we have 11 statutory missions in the Coast Guard, from search and rescue on one end to drug enforcement and Homeland Security stuff on the other end. All of those missions are in play up here in Alaska. And between myself and the other 2,000 Alaskan Coast Guard-based folks and auxiliaries and everybody else, we're doing the best job we can with what we have. But we can't do it alone. We're leveraging our partners, and we can't do it alone. We need the help of everybody in Alaska to help us do that. So that's just a quick overview. Yes, sir.
Touch on the need for a new icebreaker.
Always going to happen. If you had an opportunity this morning, probably unless you're some really crazy political wonk, you probably didn't. But the hearing today, there was both Lieutenant Governor Treadwell and Admiral Papp, the Commandant of the Coast Guard, testified today in front of Congress. And that issue just kept coming up over and over, and our good Congressman Young, we just kept bringing it up. And I think the way I would characterize that is a number of things. From a historical perspective, and Carl Yucatil's I'll point him out as a very famous Coast Guard icebreaker sailor and skipper, and somebody that knows a lot more about the trade of breaking ice than I do. But just looking at it from a historical perspective, when I came in the Coast Guard, we had 9 icebreakers, not counting Mackinac and the Great Lakes. Today, we really got 1, right? When I came in the Coast Guard, there was a lot of ice in the Arctic. And that's 34 years ago. The Arctic wasn't a big issue. That wasn't an opening area. Oil wasn't, we weren't even, you know, barely got the pipeline in back in 1977. It was just the very beginnings of even looking at any oil exploration in Alaska. Today we have 1, and we have a whole new sea opening up. We have another 1,000 miles of coastline. We have a lot more interest up there, whether it's developmental interests or environmental interests, and a lot more, as I talked about earlier, international interest in that area. Less ice in the Arctic or an open Arctic does not mean an ice-free Arctic. In fact, you can make the argument that you really need to have more icebreakers now than ever, because you don't know when that ice is coming in and out, Every time you go up there, you do have the opportunity to run into ice that is broken off from somewhere else. The margins of the season up there are always going to be in flux, and the opportunity for somebody to get stuck up there in the ice is there. I think as a nation, we need to step back for a minute and say, okay, are we an Arctic nation? Yes. Okay, what does that mean? Are we a maritime nation? Yes. Okay, what does that mean? Do we have an obligation to our nation, to the people of Alaska, to industry that may want to be up there, to anybody else who lives in that region, to provide them the same services that they would get elsewhere in the U.S.? Once we've answered some of those questions, okay, what are the requirements to do that? I think there'll always be an icebreaker as one of the solutions to doing that. People ask me a similar question to yours on, okay, are you going to build an air station up in the Arctic? Are you going to build a port in the Arctic? My answer to that is, if I had an icebreaker, I almost don't have to do that. Why? Because I have an icebreaker with a flight deck. I can put helicopters on it. I don't need a port if I've got a place where I can take care of a whole lot of our folks. If I have the ability to respond from offshore and move that response capability around, that may even actually be better. So I think an icebreaker is a tool in the toolbox that allow us to fully realize in a responsible way and develop the Arctic and be there. So kind of a long answer to, I think icebreakers are going to be part of the mix in the future. It's not my job to decide when and where those will be, but it is my job to try to point out the requirements associated with that. So thank you for the question. It's one that that always engenders a lot of interest, and from our political overseers as well, who see that as a key component, especially because you look at how long it takes to build one. If we all decided today, let's build a brand new icebreaker for the Coast Guard to go do great stuff with the opening up of the Arctic, it'd be 10 years from now before we had the thing sailing around up there. So when you look at trying to hedge against future issues, how do you do that today? We're at the point where we need to start making some decisions, like I said earlier. So thank you very much for that question.
Repeat yes? Questions. Would you stand up, please? Grab it. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. I'll go over here. Yes, ma'am?
Okay. General, I'm with Senator Begich's office. And on a related topic, there was an article today about Nome. And the ice has come into Nome as a result of the storm.
Right.
So they are short of fuel delivery by barge.
Yep.
The senator did send a letter today to Admiral Pat. Perhaps you've seen that letter, but asking about the resources about an icebreaker to free up Nome for this barge versus the capabilities that they have in the lower 48. Could you comment on that?
I can. So, and I've actually talked to a number of the commercial enterprises that had hoped to bring in the fuel in there in the first place. So, Nome is not unlike a lot of other places on the coast of Alaska that aren't connected to anywhere else and that have a whole bunch of people that live there that need stuff. One of the things that they had hoped to get this year was another, for everybody else's edification, another barge load of fuel in there to give them the necessary supply and really cushion to get through the winter in fuel. And also, quite frankly, to help keep the price of fuel down, because it's a lot cheaper to bring it in by barge than it is to fly it in. One way or another, the folks in Nome will get fuel this winter, whether it's going to be real expensive or not, or subsidized or not, whatever, that's going to have to be worked out. I've been assured by industry that there's probably enough supply now to make it through the winter, and they could buy some from other reserves that are there. It would be great if we could move a barge into Nome now with the ice that's there. And I have asked the same question on Healy, who happens to still be up in that AOR area of responsibility, if she could, before she heads south, aid in any way in helping to get that fuel in there. So whether she helps break in a barge that can bring fuel there, not unlike, quite frankly, what we do in Antarctica and other places we want to bring in fuel, whether that would work, how close could you get, whether you fill her up with fuel and you pull her in and you pump her out, you know, those kinds of decisions. So it is something that we're actively looking at, working with industry and the state and the people in Nome to try to solve that problem. I have not seen the letter that Senator Bagich has sent to Admiral Papp, but now that I know that, I'll take a look at it.
Yes,
yes, ma'am, that would be grateful. But, you know, I think that's one of those... what's happened in Nome is an inevitable surprise that's likely to happen in a lot of places. And we have less ice throughout the northern regions of the state, people are going to tend to want to move stuff in at the last minute. I'm facing that with a number of high sites right now that help us with some of our radio transponders, where the weather got bad early, and now we have a problem getting fuel in and out of there to keep them open. I think an icebreaker is part of the solution in a lot of that. Better logistics as a logistician. There's other ways you could mitigate that. There's some issues that I just learned in the same conversation with industry about low sulfur fuel and whether you can mix that with regular diesel fuel and whether you can't mix it with JP and you got to move it store it in a separate tank. So a lot of decisions that are made have nth order effects and unintended consequences about just where you can store stuff and how you can move it in. Long answer to a pretty simple question, which is, Nome didn't get their last fuel delivery, and we got to figure out a way to solve that. And I know Mayor Michaels pretty well, and she's we'll make sure they don't freeze. Yes, ma'am. Sir.
You mentioned the Great Circle route. You also mentioned Station Ethics.
Right.
Will some of that shipping be coming through the inside
waters? No, most of the shipping. That's a globalized shipping, and the way it's been characterized to me by industry, you're 2 days quicker to market in Chicago if you go through Prince Rupert from Korea than any other place. And if you look at the infrastructure investment that the Canadians have made in the Prince Rupert area, it's all connected. So the new railhead, better roads, and a much, much improved port facility there so they can handle the TEUs and the bulk cargo coming in and out of there. That's significant. 2 days is meaningful. If you can get from Korea to Prince Rupert, get it on a rail line and get stuff to Chicago or any other place in the U.S. faster than you can to a U.S. port, that has ramifications for Alaska, because that traffic comes through our waters. It also has ramifications for the rest of the nation and whether we need to make investments and improvements in some of our other ports as well. I mentioned oil. People know the pipeline that's supposed to go all the way down from Canada down to Houston area so that meet our refineries. There's decisions that have to be made as that pipeline goes forward or not, and where the Canadians are going to move it to market. All I can tell you is that the Canadians are going to move that to market. They made that clear to me. One of the ways to do that would be an oil facility in the vicinity of Prince Rupert as well. But most of that traffic is going to be east and west, as it looks for Asian markets for raw products going to the west, and manufactured goods coming to the east and to the U.S. So that's most of the water now. Dixon Entrance, and then I don't have a chart of Prince Rupert, but if you look at the way Prince Rupert is, that's all, you know, once it hits Dixon Entrance, that's inland waters from there. So, again, I'm just somewhat of the canary here in the coal mine saying, hey, that's an issue. And we just need to understand what that looks like. And that's why we spent a lot of time this year training and exercising with the Canadians over what would a non-tank vessel mishap in Dixon Entrance look like, where would it go, and we have a lot of scientific work being done in that area. So thank you. Over here.
What impact, if any, are the mandatory military cuts having on the Coast Guard here?
The Coast Guard's in a pretty good spot, and if you take a look at the way our budget played out for 2012, fiscal year 2012 that we're in right now, I think we're very well supported by both the administration and Congress. 2013, there's some people in this room that may know better than me with their political insight. I don't know where we're going in 2013. The Super Committee obviously came out and didn't deliver, what we expect them, or a substantial product to change what the triggered cuts would look like. I know that my DOD partners and colleagues are pretty pretty worried about it. Our comment on it has come out. He testified today as well that that we're going to tighten our belts like everybody else. I think for the state of Alaska, I can say with full disclosure that I know of no cuts that are coming to the state of Alaska in the near future. That doesn't mean that when the budget finally comes out in 13, there's something that I hear today don't know about. But right now, I think we're going to hold our own in the state. That's helpful. Yes, ma'am. Great question. Law of the Sea Treaty. We got some lawyers in the room that even could do this better than I can. It's been the position of now four different commandants, the CNO, several different chiefs of naval operation, the chairman of the Joint Staff, Admiral Mullen, and others that the U.S. actually has, we have signed it, we haven't ratified the Law of the Sea Treaty. The United States really needs to ratify that treaty. Besides providing us with a seat at the table and a lot of conversations that right now we don't have a lot of ability to sit at, it gives us, you know, the U.S. is a maritime nation. We're the leading maritime power in the world. It's still a fact. We need to be part of probably the most sweeping legislation in the international body right now that speaks to how we're going to go forward in the maritime environment. And if you look at our position, our being the Alaskan position, things like where the outer continental shelf ends and what is really the U.S. property and what's not, the only way you can rectify that, adjudicate that, and solve those problems so that we can know what is ours and what is not and where we can develop and where we can't, where we where we invest in some of the offshore stuff is through the Law of the Sea Treaty. So I can tell you here that it's the position of the United States Coast Guard and others that we support the Law of the Sea Treaty, and we really need to move forward on that. That's something that needs to get done so that we can be more responsible as a globalized nation. So thanks for bringing that up. Anybody else? I know this thing's driving everybody crazy. Cool. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to address you all today.